From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
nearly 50,000 Arkansans are set to lose Medicaid coverage by the end of this month, but the governor calls for a two-week halt to terminations.
The state's attorney general says there may be a defense for justices of the peace who don't want to marry same-sex couples.
Former Governor Mike Huckabee gets a few laughs and tries to separate himself from the pack at the first Republican presidential debate. KUAR's David Wallace will have analysis from a longtime political observer.
And Arkansas's top elected officials all vow to fight the new clean power rule. But is it all for show? I'm Michael Heblin.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
That's just ahead on KUAR's Week in Review. By the end of this month, nearly 50,000 Arkansans who had been enrolled in Medicaid or the private option will have lost their coverage. And this week it became such a big issue that Governor Asa Hutchinson announced a halt for at least a couple of weeks because of problems at the Department of Human Services. KUAR's Jacob Kaufman has been covering that this week. You were at the governor's press conference on Tuesday. First, explain the problems, how officials believe that some people may be improperly losing coverage or not given enough time to update income information.
The whole issue here is this is the first time that Arkansas is systematically looking at everyone in Medicaid coverage, around 600,000 people. That includes around 250,000 that are in the private option, which is Arkansas's expansion of Medicaid, part of the Affordable Care Act. And part of this is to be on Medicaid, you have to make a certain amount of money. So they're trying to verify everybody's income to say, if you make too much money, then you can't have Medicaid coverage anymore because it's for low-income people. And essentially, what's happening the first time the state is doing this, if the Department of Workforce Services can tell that your income went up 10% or down 10%, which is pretty important too, then you're automatically going to be sent a letter saying you have to re-verify your income. Send us several months' worth of pay stubs to see if you still qualify. The problem with this letter for a lot of people is that it only has a 10-day window for people to respond with all this information. And if they don't respond, they could be terminated within 10 days from their Medicaid coverage from the Department of Human Services. And the governor, he said that 10-day window is not the problem, but he did point to a problem at DHS where even if people sent their information in that 10-day window, maybe DHS didn't open the letter in time before sending out the termination notices.
While the 10-day requirement for notice is working very well, the challenge is the capability of DHS to respond to the information overload and the documents that are being sent in. And because we want to make sure that we treat people fairly and we do not wrongfully take someone off the eligibility roll, we are going to pause for 2 weeks any sending out of notices of termination in order to make sure that DHS can catch up with workload and processing the information that has been sent in by the recipients. I think this is fair. I think it's the right thing to do. The challenge is not the 10-day notice requirement. The challenge is processing the information whenever the beneficiary sends in the income verification or the payroll stubs that they have and been requested to send in. So we're going to be pausing it for 2 weeks to make sure that the termination notices are not sent out until all of the paperwork can be processed.
So there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance this week. On the same morning of that press conference where the governor said he's going to lift a hiring freeze at DHS, hire another 20 or so people, reallocate people throughout the Department of Human Services, pay them overtime, and maybe even hire some temp workers because of this tremendous backlog, because of the time limit set, that on that same day, he also sent out a press release saying that they had saved $2.5 million because of a hiring freeze on the same day that they lifted a hiring freeze. And some of that DHS backlog is showing up elsewhere through nonprofit groups with healthcare navigators. And I spoke with one of them, Leonard Stern, and these are people who originally set up to help people enroll in healthcare.gov and helped get on Obamacare. But they say they're fielding a lot of calls now from people who are confused about what's happening.
I had a consumer who recently got a job. When he applied originally, he didn't have a job. So he got the re-verification letter, wanted to make sure what to do. So he called me and I was able to submit updated pay stubs. and he still qualifies for the private option.
And about 97% of these people who have been kicked off of the private option so far, about 40 or 50,000 through the end of August, they've been kicked off, according to DHS, either because they didn't send in their information in time or because DHS simply didn't process it fast enough. So even though there's evidence of income change, there's not necessarily evidence that these people don't qualify anymore. But while the governor says that 10-day window is not a problem and that DHS will be able to handle the backlog in this next 2 weeks, the chair of the Arkansas Democratic Party, Vincent Insulaco, is very critical. He said, this problem should have been known about. It's one of the Republicans making, and that 10-day window is a problem, even if the governor doesn't think so.
Well, it sounds to me that they were not prepared. But, you know, the governor is dealing with a legislature that is dominated by, in his party, by people who don't want this program to even exist. So no wonder why they're not prepared. What they have to understand, which is what I feel so adamantly about, is that these are not numbers on a piece of paper. These are live human beings who, most of them who work really hard, probably are working 2 and 3 jobs at minimum wage and have, you know, dealing with a health insurance issue is brand new to them.
And so this really is just a tremendous amount of people in a really short span of time. It's huge numbers. We're used to in Arkansas reading about how many people gained insurance coverage month to month since they implemented the private option. We'll see where we are at the end of 2 weeks, if DHS can process this any faster. And it will, I guess we'll see eventually if people are losing their insurance because they actually make too much money or if it's just because they didn't send in the paperwork fast enough.
And the governor has been rather defensive about the 10-day time limit. That's the minimum allowed under federal law. But if you think about it, I can speak from experience from student loans. If you're paying student loans and you have a reduced payment because of income, they give you what seems like a few months to prove your income eligibility. You get a letter in the mail. You get an email. You also get phone calls if you don't respond. So to give 10 days, and if they don't have it back in that time, seems a little bit short.
And the governor would say one of the rare times he says, because the federal government said it's okay, that must mean it must be good. He said that's the federal minimum, and so that must be fine. But at the same time, the federal maximum is 90 days. So when they created the Affordable Care Act, they had a big window here. And the governor also says if we have a longer wait period, that'll mean that DHS workers have to work longer, so it might be a little bit more costly. But in the end, if these people end up having to reapply, they will get a chance to reapply. Even if they got the termination notice, they still have a number of days where they can resubmit their information, but DHS would have to look at it again even in that case. The other argument is that there are a number of other state benefits that have a 10-day window, and critics of that would say, well, but this is a new plan, and insurance coverage is something that's especially important, and you can imagine if you might be in the hospital, you might not get your letter in that period.
Well, one of the architects of the private option, State Senator David Sanders, has been saying he would rather recipients be given 30 days to respond.
Well, that's right. And, you know, he was certainly very powerful and at the center of all this back when the private option first passed back in 2013. But since then, the conservative ranks of the Republican Party have seemed to grow. A lot of people opposed to the private option and Medicaid expansion. Brian King is another state senator, and his big thing about this has been, we need to look at the Medicaid rolls. We think there are people on it who might not actually qualify for it. And the other critique is, if you can't bother to open this letter and send in the information in 10 days, how much do you value something that you are in some ways getting for free?
Well, I don't think it's unusual for people. Again, I'm speaking from my own experience. Sometimes you get items in the mail, you throw it in on the counter walking in the door, and maybe it takes a few days to look at. What was this? I've heard it described as this was a rather nondescript envelope. It didn't necessarily look like something that might be this vital to someone's health care coverage.
That was asked of the governor and Director Selig of DHS at the press conference, and neither of them could say off the top of their head what the letter looks like. So it was kind of interesting. That's something people were thinking about, that what the letter looks like. If it's something, you know, at any time you're talking about healthcare, it's confusing to anybody, especially if it might be a family that got the healthcare for the first time, possibly in generations, as a lot of these low-income people have. So, I mean, you can read the letter. It'll tell you what to do. But some of the problem with that has been even people who filled out the letter or called DHS never got their information processed. So they might have even done what was right and still lost their coverage.
Yeah, and the governor used the term, he said, some anecdotal reports of people whose eligibility hadn't changed, who did submit records that were requested, but still were canceled.
Well, with the whole idea of not everybody who's in Medicaid is going to get this letter. It's about 40% of people, and it's people whose names were triggered because their income changed by 10%. And if you look at the number of people who are on Medicaid in the private option, most of those people make below the poverty line. So even if their income went up 10%, they would still qualify.
Any indication what happens next? This has gotten a lot of political attention, and I think the governor is feeling some heat on this. Any indication what's going to happen next?
We'll have to see what really happens during this two-week moratorium. It's time for DHS to catch up to a lot of information. We'll see if these additional workers are enough. It's not clear that this will be any immediate benefit to the 40,000 or so that have already received these termination notices. But going forward after this 2 weeks, people are still going to be paying attention to these numbers because they've been pretty huge the last 2 months, 20,000 people, 30,000 people. So I imagine, but by the time that November 2016 comes around, if it turns out there's 100,000 or 150,000 people that lost their insurance because of the way the governor has chosen to process their information, not because they're no longer eligible, I mean, this could be a pretty big issue to kick 100,000 people off their plans.
And worth noting that there is a group that the governor appointed. He was able to get the legislature to continue the private option at least through the end of next year, but he does have a task force studying this and deciding what the future of it should be here in the state. So on to another item this week. We had the Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, issue an advisory opinion suggesting that justices of the peace might be able to use the state's, what's the term?
Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, which was passed in the spring.
Right. Might be able to use that as a defense for not marrying people. Now, you do have the circuit clerks in each county who do have to issue same-sex licenses, but there's been some question from justices of the peace who often will perform ceremonies when a couple doesn't want to do it at a church, whether or not they have to follow this. Talk a little about what the AG had to say and what you found out from one of those justices of the peace.
Justices of the peace, they're a little bit at peculiar office in this regard, because as you mentioned, the county clerk would certainly have to file the marriage licenses and issue them. Justices of the peace, however, they are not required to perform any wedding ceremonies at all as their county level position. However, the speculation is that if they do perform a marriage for an opposite sex couple, then they will be obligated to provide that equal public service to anyone in the community, whether it be same-sex or opposite-sex. And this was an opinion request of the Attorney General, so it's non-binding, but it is her giving a little bit of encouragement maybe to some of those opposed. It was asked for actually by a Democratic state senator in Magnolia, but I spoke with Cleburne County Justice of the Peace, Alan Malone, and he said he was encouraged by this. And Cleburne County is where a clerk resigned back in the summer, but she didn't want to issue same-sex marriage licenses.
I was concerned that I would have litigation against me for doing one and not the other. And I am a Christian, and I won't do same-sex services. My thoughts were that if I did none, you know, because I'm not obligated as a JP to do any, I just have to stop doing all of them. People have called me, because I was the one doing most of them, they've called me like, I don't know how I'm going to get married, or where am I going to go? And I feel for them, I really do, except it's just too much of a risk for me to take until I'm sure that I would be defended.
So that was Alan Malone. He's one of a dozen or so JPs in Cleburne County, one of the more conservative counties on this issue in north central Arkansas.
And you actually called around to a couple of different offices?
Yeah, I called a few different counties who had justices of the peace, whose county clerks before had said that they didn't want to do same-sex marriage licenses. And in this instance, Dana Guffey in Cleburne County had resigned. And Al Malone, though, he said that he wouldn't mind being the standard, bearing the banner on this issue for other JPs. As long, though, his main issue is, I wouldn't mind doing the sacrifice for myself or being the subject of this public spectacle, but I really need some compensation for legal defense. And so he said maybe family counsel could help me out or something like that. But he didn't have any too specific plans, but he thought it was encouraging. On the other hand, one of the state's premier legal scholars on these types of issues, John DePippa at UALR's Bowen School of Law, he said that the attorney general's opinion really offers more of a false sense of encouragement.
You know, imagine if a justice of the peace decided that he or she had a religious objection to performing an interracial marriage. Now, they would surely lose that lawsuit because there's a compelling interest to enforce constitutional rights. By the same argument, there's a compelling interest to require government officials, like justices of the peace, to uphold people's rights. And so while there is some encouragement, I think the opinion doesn't go far enough and explain that it's really a very false encouragement, because ultimately I would expect that courts would say, yes, you may have a religious burden, but no, you have to carry out your job.
So the attorney general's opinion has definitely sparked a bit of hope for some of those opposed to same-sex marriage who still want to serve in their public capacities to officiate over opposite-sex couples. Bob Ballinger, the sponsor of this Religious Freedom Act, he mentioned it this week in a debate rehashing it for the Political Animals Club. But despite this encouragement, it seems like the same end, the same outcome is court battles and a court system that clearly nationally has favored same-sex marriage.
And where are we with the governor had initially put the bill up allowing phrase?
Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
The governor had originally put up the legislature had originally put up the Religious Freedom Act, and the governor eventually asked them to withdraw that, to change it, to make it more in line with national standards. But do we know much about how that act will end up playing? It hasn't really faced any kind of court challenge at this point.
Well, because of the public nature of Justices of the Peace, it's not a private entity, it's not a private person at that point. He's a public official who got there by, as DePippa said, by virtue of him being elected to public office. DePippa really thinks that this does not apply to a public official offering a public service. You simply can't choose to serve part of the public, but not the other part. But as it stands right now in Cleburne County, there's not a single justice of the peace who signed up with the county clerk as available to officiate weddings. And Alan Malone, the JP, he said that's caused problems, that he's gotten lots of calls from people who want to get wed through a justice of the peace, but he just tells them, sorry, I can't help you.
This week, you had a lot of attention paid to the race for president, as there was the first debate for the Republican candidates. This was limited to only the first the top 10 candidates, according to five recent national surveys. Fox News didn't release it until 2 days before the debate exactly who those 10 were be, but safely within that group was former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, who, when you merged all these polls together, came in fourth place. So up there toward the center of the stage. And of course, Donald Trump has been getting most of the attention. And for me watching it, really seemed like it took a lot of effort for Mike Huckabee to be heard. In fact, his first question and chance to talk, other than the introduction, came 17 minutes into the debate when he spoke about his opposition to abortion and Planned Parenthood in particular, said it's not enough for the federal government to just defund Planned Parenthood for any services they provide, but said that there are acts in the Constitution that should protect the children, the unborn. And he used the phrase, and he has used this elsewhere, that the Supreme Court is not the supreme being. So an interesting one. We'll have a discussion here in just a second, but thought I'd play here during the closing statements that were allowed to each candidate. Here's what former Governor Huckabee had to say, and funny because it seemed like he was targeting Donald Trump, who's been by far leading in the polls. And in fact, in Arkansas, according to a poll published in the Log Cabin Democrat, the newspaper in Conway, Donald Trump is actually ahead of Mike Huckabee here in his own state. Don't know a lot of information about the poll or the organization that conducted it, but if that is indeed the case, very interesting. And it sounded almost like here in this one comment, like he was taking a shot at Donald Trump. But here's what he actually ended up saying.
It seems like this election has been a whole lot about a person who's very high in the polls, but doesn't have a clue about how to govern. A person who has been filled with scandals and who could not lead. And of course, I'm talking about Hillary Clinton. I think America is in trouble, but it's not beyond repair. But it's going to take leadership who sees the greatness of this country and who believes that once again we can be one nation under God. I'll be my best to do that, and thank you for your support.
And that cut courtesy of Fox News, which broadcast the debate. One of at least two times that Huckabee got a few laughs during the debate. Obviously, very scripted moment there, but it sounded like he was ready, that whenever it was his chance to talk, he had a few powerful statements ready. Well, KUAR's David Wallace spoke with Hal Bass, political scientist at Ouachita Baptist University, to get his thoughts immediately after the debate on Thursday night. And worth noting that former Governor Huckabee did graduate from OBU. Its School of Education is named after him. And Bass notes that two of Huckabee's children were also students in the political science department, where Bass is a professor. But here's what he told David Wallace.
What do you see as his finest moments in the debate Thursday night?
I thought he had a couple of good sound bites. I thought the format worked generally in his favor. He is very glib. I did not think he was the main show tonight. It was a solid performance, but I think ultimately he ran in place. He had, I think, five or six moments in the spotlight in what was a very crowded field. And the ones that I thought were the best responses, he had a discussion of the entitlement issue with Governor Christie. And I thought he was able to integrate some pretty strong populist themes with some strong support for entitlements and some criticism for government. He talked about the Iran nuclear deal and got in a pretty good soundbite there, playing off President Reagan's old line about trust but verify, and claiming that what President Obama has been doing is trusting but vilifying. And again, that's exemplary of his capacity to craft these soundbites. I thought that he fielded a question on U.S. military culture by identifying with a strong military and claiming the military is not a place for social experimentation in a way that probably resonated with the Republican primary electorate, if not the broader general electorate. He had a pretty boilerplate answer on the size of government and his support for devolution, or putting power back in the hands of the states. On social issues, he came up pretty strong for using presidential power to take action to address what he sees as a Supreme Court that's gone rogue here. But it was a solid performance.
That last one you mentioned, I believe, was his first answer to a question,
right?
And he I had not heard him talk in those terms about using the Constitution to establish the fetus as a person, using the 5th and 14th Amendment. Is that something new that he has started advocating?
Well, I think he has been very, very critical of a number of recent Supreme Court decisions, but particularly the one that pertained to the same-sex marriage this past term. And I think he is looking for ways and means to assert power against the Supreme Court within the political system. And I'm not quite sure how a president asserts the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments in this capacity, but it's an interesting argument he's putting forward.
And then at the end, he, you know, of course, Arkansas voters are familiar with his style and the fact that he has pretty good comedic timing in his speeches, a skill I'm sure that was honed in years of television with on the same channel, in fact, as the debate. But he got a pretty good head fake and a zinger against Hillary.
Exactly. His closing statement was introduced in a fashion that led people to think he was probably getting ready to take a shot at Donald Trump, something that people had wondered if anyone would do that in the course of the debate. And it turned out the description he was putting forward, which appeared to be directed toward Trump, was actually directed toward Hillary Clinton. And it was well received by the audience. And again, I think it did bring to mind the Huckabee that the country saw back in the 2008 campaign, a likable, genial everyman here. Elsewhere in the debate, I thought sometimes he was a little strident and angry sounding, but in that closing statement, it was the old Huckabee.
And so since that is the last impression that he left the audience with, did he help himself overall?
It's hard to say. And again, a lot's going to depend on how the media plays it. And my bet is that Huckabee is not going to be a big story in the media analysis of this debate. I think a lot of the oxygen is going to be directed toward Donald Trump, of course. I think that a lot of folks are going to see Ohio Governor Kasich as having put forward a good performance on a home turf. I think that really all the candidates did solidly here. I don't think there was any moment where anybody really damaged their prospects unalterably, although I think some of Trump's remarks about not guaranteeing he'd support the Republican nominee might be damaging down the road. But I would say Huckabee pretty much ran in place.
Yeah, is the pledge that they jumped right out of the gate with, raising the hand if you will not support the nominee and Donald Trump took the bait, is that the headline overall from this?
I think that'll be a major story coming out of it. And I think in many respects there were two debates tonight. Well, actually three if you talk about the one at 4 o'clock with the seven other folks who are announced contenders. But the two in the primetime debate were the nine contenders responding to questions and Trump talking back and forth with the moderators. It seemed to me that much of the airtime was a direct interaction between Trump and the moderators as opposed to engagement with the other candidates on stage.
You know, in the last cycle, 2012, there were so many debates and the same cast of characters that we got to know very well over the course of those primaries, because every week it seemed we had a debate. Now with 17 candidates, though, the dynamics will change a lot more as we go along, I would imagine. And is there more pressure on each individual candidate, you know, to make his name immediately? And in that sense, was this... maybe not do or die, but was it of heightened importance for the governor?
Well, I think the real question is, what is his niche in the campaign field, and what's his compelling narrative? It was reasonably clear back in 2008, and he was reasonably successful. While he didn't achieve the nomination, he ran what's generally considered to be a very, very good campaign. I think he's in a more crowded field. 8 years later, he's been struggling to kind of gain traction here. And again, I don't think he hurt himself at all tonight, but I don't see that it was a game changer in terms of catapulting him out of what has been a consistent middle of the pack position into the top tier.
Okay, Dr. Bass, thanks for your time very much.
Sure thing.
And that's KUAR's David Wallace talking with Hal Bass about the debate. Also worth noting that one of the presidential candidates will be coming through Arkansas this coming week. Ted Cruz will be in Little Rock on Wednesday, where Jacoby's, is at the Republican Party headquarters?
Yeah, he'll be at the Republican Party headquarters in Little Rock in the early afternoon, mid-morning. I believe that'll be open to the public. It should be in the parking lot there. And then he's going to take a trip up to Van Buren, give more of another speech, another rallying place there.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people will be watching that because he's certainly gotten a lot of attention. And if indeed Huckabee is no longer in first place in Arkansas, if this state is up for grabs, then we might see a lot more presidential candidate visits.
And that was the hope kind of when they moved the primary during the legislative session to the to March, that be part of this SEC Southern primary. They expected a lot more candidates to come to Arkansas. Of course, Donald Trump gave their keynote at their annual dinner recently, but it was revealed that all the presidential candidates were invited to give that keynote speech, and Trump's the only one that said yes, so maybe Huckabee's thinking twice about that now.
Yeah. Well, we also had news this week when President Barack Obama announced his final version of the Clean Power Plan. This is to reduce carbon emissions, mainly at dirty coal plants around the country. Several of them are in Arkansas. More than half of the electricity in the state comes from coal plants, many of which, mainly by Entergy, would have to be retrofitted filters or scrubbers put on them, or some even potentially closed. But Jacob, a big response overwhelmingly by the state's political leaders against this.
The response from Attorney General Leslie Rutledge was much as it has been in the months and years preceding this since she's been elected. There's been a draft of this Clean Power Rule, and now it's been finalized. And the argument is it's an overreach by the federal government, and a point that's stressed more often maybe is that it could lead to some rate hikes for Arkansas ratepayers. However, in this final rule, it is different than the draft rule, and it looked like the federal government did listen to some criticism from Arkansas. Our original target was to bring down our carbon emissions by 44% by 20 or 30 or so. They lowered that down to 36%. So, and Arkansas has an unusually high burden because of reliance on coal that you mentioned earlier. And part of this final rule is states get an extra 2 years to begin implementing the plan starting in 2022 instead of 2020. So even though there were some concessions from the EPA, Attorney General Rutledge opposed it. She has filed a suit with 15 other states to try to stop this from going into effect. Governor Hutchinson released a statement saying, as might be expected, that he opposes this federal plan to for cleaner air. But he, at the same time, he also called on state agencies and public and the Public Service Commission to begin planning or begin looking at the best ways to comply with this rule. And that's what Glenn Hooks of Sierra Club of Arkansas, their director, he thinks that compliance moving forward is really the only option, and that any resistance being offered might be more talk than substance.
The smart utilities and the smart businesses are figuring out the wave of the future, how we're going to deal with solar energy, how we're going to deal with wind, and how we're going to deal with this transition away from fossil fuels that is happening all across the country undeniably. And people who say that it's not are just not telling the truth, or they're not facing reality. The reality is that of the 500 coal plants in the country right now, 200 of them have been scheduled for retirement just over the last few years. People see the writing on the wall, and utilities want to make sure that they do a good job of keeping the lights on. They're going to see the wave of the future. That's why you see utilities in Arkansas not only building their own renewables here in the state, but also purchasing renewable energy from out of state as part of their load here in the state. They know what's going on. Whether they're going to say it publicly or not is a different story.
And Hooks noted that this year alone so far, there's been four different renewable energy projects in Arkansas, and they're the first ones. So there is some effort at least, and some of these are by public utilities and some are by private companies. But it's not just about climate change and environmentalists. Also, at the State Department of Health, they say that there are serious health risks tied to these carbon-emitting plants, particularly the coal plants, whether it's mercury that ends up getting in the water or some other health problems. And I spoke with Dr. Joseph Bates, who's kind of the second command at the Department of Health.
The costs of the health effects are never computed. They compute the cost of the electricity generated as a result of coal, since it's the cheapest source of energy, but they never compute the offsetting costs of increased health effects. Arkansas has been graded by county about the health effects of ozone, and Pulaski County generally gets an F, the lowest possible grade, and so does Crittenden County at West Memphis. And, of course, ozone is the one that's so hard on people that have asthma and chronic obstructive lung disease. It really, and it tends to accumulate more in certain seasons of the year, particularly summertime, when there's a thermal inversion fairly often, and it sort of traps the air.
Important to remember that all this talk is, it's not just from the Obama administration, from the EPA, it's not just about becoming, using clean energy for clean energy's sake. The reason is because there's science behind it in their estimation, whether it is about the climate or whether it's about health effects.
Well, the fight will be ongoing at least for a while. I think it was Thursday, maybe Wednesday, that Attorney General Rutledge announced that Arkansas is joining with 15 other states in asking the EPA for a stay in the Clean Power Plan. But also they're planning additional legal action to consider any options to try and challenge this.
So the real question, I think, for the state moving forward is, while this legal challenge is going on, while the state's Republican candidates are certainly, I can't imagine them switching their interpretation of climate change science or anything like that anytime soon, but while these litigation is going on, the question is going to be, to what extent is Governor Hutchinson and the state's energy companies, are they actually planning for this? And part of the deal with this is, while Arkansas would have to cut its carbon emissions, it's up to Arkansas to figure out what they want to do, what kind of mix or blend of energy they want. So it could be any kind of proportion of natural gas or wind or solar or nuclear or whatever it is, or purchasing clean energy from other states. And so we'll see what that makeup ends up being. But Arkansas certainly has a harder climb than most because of a reliance on coal up to this point.
Well, with that, we'll wrap up this week's podcast. I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
KUAR is a service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You can follow us on Facebook. And if you like the podcast, if you're not already a subscriber, we hope you'll go to iTunes and subscribe there. Our theme music is by Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.